Hello, my name's Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I had the absolute pleasure of speaking to Head of English and author, the wonderful Sarah Donarski. Now, two pieces of pretty exciting news before we dive in. First, I have finished recording all 10 of my online on-demand CPD courses based around the ideas from Tips for Teachers. I'll give you the big 10. Here they are. Number one course is Habits and Routines. Then it's Means of Participation. It's a good one, that one. Checking for Understanding. There's a course on Responsive Teaching, Planning, Prior Knowledge, Explanations, Modeling and Worked Examples. Course 8 is Student Practice. Then it's Memory and Retrieval. And finally, Homework, Marking and Feedback. I've kept the cost nice and low. There's hundreds of short, sharp videos in there. You can access it at any time, revisit it at any time. I hope you'll find this really useful. You head to the Tips for Teachers website and click on CPD, you'll find all the details about those. And you can also book me for face-to-face Tips for Teachers workshops, keynotes, presentations, and so on. All the details are at tipsforteachers.co.uk/CPD. So that's exciting piece of news number one. An exciting piece of news number two is that I'm delighted to say that the Tips for Teachers book will be released on the 6th of January 2023. Just this morning, I've signed off on the final proof. I'm really excited. It's come out so well. The designers and editors have done a fantastic job on it. The marketing campaign for this, are you ready? Tips for Teachers, that's the title of the book, 400 plus ideas to improve your teaching. Tried to make this one of the most practical, actionable CPD books that are out there. There's so many ideas covering all the things that we've talked about on the Tips for Teachers podcast, but also all the things that I've learned visiting schools and teachers, working with schools and teachers and students all around the world over the last few years. So if you want to make sure you get one in the first print run, you can pre-order that now on Amazon or John Catt. And there's, if you go to the Tips for Teachers website, there's a book section, /book, you find out all about that. Right, let me shut up now. Let's get back to the show. So let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful Sarah Donarski. Spoiler alert, here are Sarah's 5 tips. Tip 1, know how to effectively assess. Tip 2, choose the right feedback type. Tip 3, this is my favorite, beware of student bias. Tip 4, use where possible dialogic teaching. And finally, tip 5, ignite the CPD culture. They're really good ones, these, you know. All the tips are timestamped, so you can jump straight to the one you want to listen to first. And as ever, videos of Sarah's tips are available on the Tips for Teachers website if you wish to share them with colleagues. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Sarah Donarski to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, Sarah, how are you?
Hi, Craig. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Very good. Right, for the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
Yeah, so I'm currently a head of English in the northwest of England. I'm an educational writer and speaker with particular interest, I would say, in assessment, feedback and bias.
Amazing, fantastic. Well, let's dive straight in. What's tip number one that you've got for us today?
Right, so my tip number one is to know how to effectively assess. Obviously, I said that I'm massively interested in assessment, predominantly because I think when we have a look at what assessment is, fundamentally, it is controlled, it's small scale, it's low stakes, and it's the sole purpose of it, at least up until the final exams, is to improve the learner and identify any misconceptions that a learner has. And I think understanding that definition actually enables us to recalibrate the way we see assessment across the course of our curriculum. So I would probably break that into two areas. I think first thing, particularly in an English setting, but this happens a bit more naturally in maths and music, say, is to employ incremental assessment. And the second thing is to employ assessment that enables flexible learning. So I'm happy to talk more about both of those.
This is good, this is good. Can you tell us a little bit more about those two facets, Sarah? Just dive a bit deeper into those last two things, if that's okay.
Yeah, no worries. So the first would be to employ incremental assessment. And I think this It's quite a practical way to look at the theories and the discussions that have been coming out perpetually by the big hitter in assessment, Dylan William, who probably from the get-go regretted, he's spoken quite a lot about this, regretting the definitions of formative and summative assessment, because actually he's sort of done a complete U-turn on that and said that every single assessment is formative until the final examinations. And again, that's what we assess for. I'm not assessing to judge. I'm assessing to identify misconceptions, right? So when I'm looking at, say, a Macbeth essay, across the course, to get to the end goal, and Dylan William also speaks about this, knowing at first what the end goal is. Say the end goal is that my students can go into a Macbeth exam and write a question or write a response, an essay response to any question that comes up about a theme or character. There are so many steps along the way that I need to break down and skills that I need to know they have to get to that goal. And so I think in your curriculum planning, if you break those skills down, so from the tiniest of they understand the play, they have knowledge about the play, to they can write an introduction, to they can write an analytical paragraph, to they can do that when, say, I give them three themes to study and then I throw one at them, to then the complete unknown of the final assessment. And when you do that, then you actually find that assessment becomes very nice and fluid, because all you're trying to assess is, do they have knowledge? And you can do that through using multiple choice, very short answers, very short question and answers, to just getting them to write paragraphs and paragraphs about various different themes, because if they can't write a paragraph, they're not going to write an essay. So it actually enables assessment to be that bit more fluid, and again, low stakes, which is what you want, right? We're just going to write a paragraph today. We're going to really hone in on that. And I think employing that more in English particularly, but again, in all subjects, is really the key to making sure that conversations are happening in the right direction, and that assessment is really being used, like I said, to identify these misconceptions and move the learner forward, which is fundamentally the core of why we assess prior to the final examination.
Love this. I love this one, Sarah. So just a couple of questions here. What are some of the ways you see assessments go wrong? What are some of the kind of classic traps that perhaps teachers will fall into where they're not going to get the things that we want to get out of the assessments out of it?
Well, I think the biggest mistake, and I've 100% done this, is teachers will assess without a secure understanding that their students, so they will assess bigger before they assess small. Like I've said, if we look at this incrementally, so they go straight in for those end goals, like I'm going to throw this Macbeth essay at them, when I haven't yet assessed that my students understand the play, I haven't yet assessed that they can recall quotations, I haven't yet assessed that they understand, what Macbeth is doing at this particular point. And so therefore, if you throw that final assessment at them, actually, it's a waste of time, not just for the student, but for you as a teacher, because you'll be marking, and it depends on how you mark, but what I envision is if you're throwing that bigger thing, it's probably more of a traditional written marking thing, and you'll be like, you need to know your quotations, whereas had you been quite close monitoring in a low stakes way, how well that students knew their quotations in the first place, then it would save the feedback for later if you jump to the bigger assessment too soon.
Interesting. Right, I've been waiting for somebody to ask this to, Sarah. You're just my person here, right?
So go on.
A mistake, well, I think it was a mistake that I used to make, was all my assessments were topic themed. So an example here, 2 weeks teaching the kids Pythagoras, and then here comes the Pythagoras end of topic assessment. Now, the reason I think that was a mistake was because you get this kind of illusion of mastery. The kids nail Pythagoras, and then we move on to the next topic, and then they nail that one. But of course, because I haven't been doing retrieval, it's all performance and they've forgotten it, you know, in the high stakes exam. The problem, another problem with it is it gives the message that cramming is actually quite an effective strategy, because if you know exactly what's going to be on the test and you, you know, just absolutely hammer that then for 3 hours the night before, you're probably going to do all right on it. Then you get to, you know, your GCSE where it could be on anything, and then you realise that that strategy isn't going to be effective. So I thought I had that sorted. But then I hear people say that actually, no, it's a good idea if the kids know exactly what they're going to be assessed on so that they can prepare adequately, they can learn these effective revision strategies and so on. So where do you stand on kind of topic themed assessment versus kind of anything could be on the assessment?
I think that's a great question. And actually, I recently spoke about this. I think if you break down, at least this is how I think about it, but I do think it's an effective way. And I've seen educational papers do this in a different level for biology, where they break down the learning journey into these four categories. As a novice learner, a rote learner, an inflexible learner, and a flexible learner being the final. And I think what we sometimes do, and that was going to be my second point where I was talking about assessment to encourage flexible learning, is we sometimes, when we prepare students incrementally, perhaps too much, we get them from a novice to a rote learner so they can recall what we're saying. Then we get them to an inflexible learner. Like you said, they have this mastery in what we've given them because they've had adequate time. But what they can't be then, we're not assessing them then in how to be a flexible learner, which is where they get given a situation of the unknown. So I completely agree with you that there needs to be incremental assessment to build confidence towards a particular topic. But what we definitely need to throw on top of that is that level of flexibility, is where it is a completely unknown environment and they're able to apply the knowledge to that particular situation. And I think where we can really build this in quite a lot is in the Key Stage 3 curriculum. I think kind of taking what Mary Myatt says about the Key Stage 3 curriculum needing to be the intellectual powerhouse of our curriculum design, I think what we should be doing is spending a lot more time in the Key Stage 3 curriculum, not just rote learning and building mastery towards particular subjects, which we might do more at GCSE, but actually the throwing in very odd flexible learning situations, such as, you know, right, you've learnt this, you've learnt Romeo and Juliet, here is a picture. Apply what you know about Romeo and Juliet to this picture, just enabling that level of play with learning that I think you really only, like if you think about it, most students really only get flexible learning when they go into their examinations. And then it's no wonder that they fall down, because we actually haven't tested them necessarily in the unknown, in the ability to apply all of that into a completely unknown situation. And that's where you get students who get thrown at GCSE when they have, for example, I remember a few years ago, there was, sorry for the English examples, but you know, there was a Jekyll and Hyde question a few years ago. And obviously Jekyll and Hyde, you think themes, I think duality, you know, power, concealment, fear, you know, you think of all of these classic themes which teachers would have taught, and then they would believe they're teaching flexible learning because they're like, oh, they can go in and do these, but actually there's still an element there of unknown. And the question was help. How does Jekyll and Hyde explore help? And what they would need to do is go, right, well, there's a fear towards help, seeking help. You know, there would need to be that complete level of flexible application, but it meant that a lot of students fell down. So I think just teaching to subject specifics, as you've given that example, I think will have that negative effect. I think where we could really utilize going a bit beyond that is earlier on, to encourage students to be a bit more confident in situations that they're not prepared for.
This is interesting, this. Just one more thing from me on this.
Go on.
I don't know if this is a math-specific thing, so I'm interested in your perspective on this. But one good thing about kind of topic-specific assessments is you can go a bit deeper. So if I'm asking you, if I've taught you Pythagoras and I set you like an 8-question assessment, low-stakes quiz or whatever, on Pythagoras, the chances are the final two questions, we're going to be going pretty deep. It's going to be some conceptual understanding. Maybe I'm weaving in some different areas of maths. Maybe it's contextual, all that kind of stuff. Versus if you do mixed topic assessments, what tends to happen in maths is that they then almost revert to quite kind of surface level procedural style knowledge, because you've got, all of a sudden you've got eight questions. So I'm only going to ask, say, one of those questions is going to be Pythagoras. So I'll probably just ask kind of a procedural Pythagoras question. Then I've got another fractions question. I'll just ask, you know, quite a straightforward fractions question. And my fear there is when you have these kind of mixed topic assessments, you don't really get that depth of understanding, assessment of that depth of understanding, because you're trying to cover too broader spectrum of content. I don't know if that makes any sense, and if you can relate to that in any way in your subject.
I would come back, and it goes with the purpose of the tip that I'm trying to say. Like, what is the purpose of that assessment?
Yeah.
So why are you developing an assessment with five or six? And is it because there is a need that these students will go into an exam or go into a particular thing where they're going to need to switch very quickly between those different schools of knowledge, in which case assessing that is super important. You know, we will eventually in English get to a point where students are going to need to stop writing Shakespeare midway through a two-hour exam and start writing about poetry. So actually assessing eventually that they can deal with the exhaustion of that time and that mental shift is actually really important for us. But if you're just trying to trick them and trap them, there's probably no purpose to that assessment, because again, how useful is that feedback? And again, if we're just looking at assessment with that core definition of being purposeful, because we are trying to figure out where students' misconceptions are and how to move them forward, then there's no purpose to trapping them by doing that particular exercise either. So I think that's where you would see probably some assessments being planned poorly. And, you know, I've had the fortunate experience of moving into a head of department role, and that has given me a lot of autonomy. And every time we have an assessment, we sit down and we say, right, this is what our assessment looks like. Is this what we want our students to know? Is this assessing them in all the skills so that we can identify their misconceptions to move them forward effectively to the next thing that we're doing? You know, and that, because that is that purpose. It's not to trap them, it's not to judge them. It is for us to know that they are in the right academic place to move forwards comfortably and appropriately.
It's really interesting. I never thought about that, practicing the switch between topics. That's really interesting, that. That's fantastic. All right, Sarah, what is tip number two, please?
Okay, so tip number two is closely related. And again, it does go with that idea of assessment, but it is to choose the right feedback type. So I actually think that you can't separate assessment and feedback, especially if you're looking at assessment as being something to help. When we talk about assessment, it must be integral with feedback. And when I was writing with researchers, the original title of the assessment book was actually Assessment, Marking and Feedback, because as a collective, you can't separate them. We shortened it down because it's easier to say, I'm assuming. But it is so important that, okay, so when I'm saying, right, I'm going to give them a quiz or a short answer question, how am I feeding back on that so that we are then developing the right movements forward? And so where you sort of imagine the incremental steps towards that final assessment, you can also imagine incremental stages of feedback, moving from, say, you know, you can peer mark or whole group marking with a multiple choice test. But then what do you do with that as well? So, for when I teach Macbeth, obviously, given that it's closed book and knowledge of the text is key to succeeding, we will start every lesson with a low stakes quiz. Where students get their responses wrong, it's not for me to be like, oh, you've only got 68, I'm going to write that in my mark book. It's right, highlight the ones that you've gotten incorrect, because those are where your knowledge gaps are. I will test this again in a week. So your homework is to study, or your, you know, after school is to study those, particularly those areas, because they're the ones that are obviously falling short when it comes to your memory recall. So in terms of then how you can provide feedback, I think that's a really important discussion for departments to have, because otherwise then you do get into this perhaps poorly planned, immediate recall, like for teachers to go immediately back to just written marking without anything being done with it. You know, that sort of, I receive your work, I will mark it and I deliver it back to you. And actually a bit more of a discussion in curriculum planning alongside assessment with feedback, I think would encourage more discussion about what are we doing with that feedback.
This is, again, another massive one you've gone for here, Sarah.
Sorry,
I love this. No, we've got to do the big issues on this show. I like this. I've struggled with this, with feedback in mathematics. And again, I'm always interested from a cross-subject perspective here. There's certainly been a pleasing shift in most schools away from kind of long-form written feedback, because what tends to happen, teacher spends hours doing it, you give it back to the kids, you're lucky if they glance at it, or if they do, perhaps they can't then kind of act upon it. It's quite difficult to act upon it. And Dylan Williams suggests making feedback into detective work, and I've played around with that idea. I think that can work quite well. I guess my big question is, how are the kids, so let's take the Macbeth essay, so let's say you take that in, you do some written feedback. What kind of written feedback do you find that kids can then act upon? Is there a certain way that you either phrase things or a certain level of depth that you go into where a child can actually read it and then can independently get on with improving that work? Because that feels to me the big challenge. When you've got 30 kids, you've got to give them something that they can then kind of crack on with. How does that play out in English?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And again, I think this, and I know obviously Daisy would have spoken about this, but I think I don't think you can do feedback effectively without models and without perhaps a practical breaking down of skills. So returning back to skills that you can assess that student might need. So again, learning quotations, that's a nice practical bit of feedback that you could give to a student that you could then assess separately and low stakes to then re-implement later. So it is about thinking about practical things that the student can move forward with. In terms of written feedback though, and I think this is why the discussion to me is so important, and I'll probably mention this in my next tip a little bit as well, is how that feedback is received. And I think if you have a good understanding of where each feedback type has its pitfalls, then I think that it also helps to deliver more effective feedback. So for example, if you are saying, okay, I have fortune enough to have a small A-level class and I want to give students one-to-one feedback, verbal feedback on their essay, right? Then you've got to remember that actually verbal feedback isn't actually better than written feedback. They are evidentially the same level of effect in the same way that written and whole group feedback is the same. Because there are processes limiting that student from retaining that information. So if I sit down and have a one-to-one conversation for about 20 minutes with a child on a piece of work they've done, we have to think about cognitive overload in that process. That, okay, I might have walked away going, I have just given the absolute best verbal feedback to that student, and I have been really thorough and very clear. But what that student walks away with is something that we also need to consider. What is happening in their mental processes whilst we're giving that 20 minutes? And how can we then, again, just allow ourselves to use extra resources to make that feedback the absolute best that it can be, such as getting them to record it? If you know your student is not a student who is particularly independent, probably would never listen to that recording again, getting them to minimize what you've said in that 20 minutes to 5 clear things. Like, tell me what I've told you there. What are your next steps? And having that that conversation a bit more clearly and openly. Because again, if you don't understand that cognitive overload can happen in feedback, then you walk away and you think, I've given this amazing feedback. And then we see those issues happen again and again.
That's great. Just one more thing on this from me, Sarah. I'm really interested in these kind of next steps, because I think this is where a lot of feedback, certainly that I've given, has fallen down. So let's, again, another maths example. Let's imagine you're teaching your kids to factorize quadratic expressions or whatever it is. You can, you know, you correct one of them, and then you can say to the kids, okay, right, you find the other mistakes and try and correct them and so on. And that can work well in the moment. But unless then they've got somewhere then to go away and then further practice that, whether they've got so that they can then take, you know, this new thing that they've got their head around and then, you know, practice it and solidify it and so on, there's a danger that we get this classic performance learning thing where kids are just performing in response to that feedback, but then a week later we give them a question and, you know, they revert back to stage one. I get the sense in maths this is a little bit easier to do. I'm intrigued how on earth this works in English. So let's imagine, you know, you've given this feedback on the Macbeth essay to a child. Is it a case of they just go away and rewrite the essay or try and apply that to a different essay? What does the follow-up kind of work to that feedback look like?
Yeah. So, and again, I think different schools would apply different different ways of doing this, hopefully. But yeah, one of the things that I like to, well, one of the things I've spoken about recently is identifying when you see these, are they mistakes or are they misconceptions, I think is the first question. Is this because, you know, sometimes I'm sure is the case in maths that a student might just write, they know what they're doing, they've just written a three instead of a two because they were being lazy and rushing or whatever it is. And you will have your knowledge, obviously, and your understanding of your class that you will be able to say, you know what, actually, I've seen this a couple of times now. This isn't a mistake. This is a misconception. And a good example of this in English is capital letters. You know, some students are very lazy with putting capital letters at the start of their sentences. They don't have a misconception that capital letters aren't a thing, mostly. They're just being lazy. And so it's a mistake. And you'll say, right, you know, look at your capital letters. For misconceptions, I think having a sheet at the front or back of a book with the topics that students have done, so a very quick sheet that you just have date, topic, misconception. And if you say to a student, right, I know I've had this conversation with this student three or four times about the fact that they're not writing their topic sentences at the beginning of their essays. I know I've had that conversation with them a lot. So I'd be like, right, I've had this conversation with you a couple of times, turn to your misconception sheet and write it down for this topic. And then before they hand in any work thereafter, double check your misconception sheet and check that you have actually done the things that I last gave you feedback on. And I think those little nods and those reminders that you won't take in that work unless they have actively thought about feedback that you've given them before, is nice, because then it will force them, you know, like we said, learning comes from memory, from the fact that you have things at the forefront of your memory and the things that you're thinking about. So we as teachers have to make students think about those things before we just take in their work. Otherwise, we're thinking about it, but they're not.
Brilliant, brilliant. Was there anything else you wanted to add on this before we move on to tip three?
Yeah, I did just want to quickly say, obviously, in sort of thinking about, these are all big, nice discussions about feedback, I completely understand. But the complexities of getting a school to implement these things are actually really, really challenging. And I think partly to do with the reporting system. I think some schools are, when we report, and it comes with that idea, like we know there's so much research going, right, actually if we take off grades from work, if we remove a grade and we just focus on the feedback, then students will be more encouraged to look at that rather than a grade, right? Mm. So Ruth Butler, obviously, in 88, and then numerous studies thereafter. But if you've got a reporting system still based on that number system, then it becomes very challenging because the conversation is still about that. So if, I don't know, systems of reporting. So one of the things we did in a reporting overhaul a few years ago was break down the reporting system about learning behaviors. So does this student respond to feedback? And it's like a positive or a negative, you know, like in just actually the way that we were doing reporting was less about the number and of so much more a breakdown of learning behavior. And then it also made conversations about learning better at parents' conferences because you were able to track reports, not based on numbers, because again, much is probably the same with maths, where students might get an eight in Macbeth, and then a six and a three in poetry. And you have to sit there and explain to a parent that they haven't gone backwards, we've just started a new topic, and their knowledge and understanding and awareness and maybe their interest in this is not as strong as Macbeth, and they haven't quite mastered it, and, you know, we will build them there. Whereas if you say, you know what, actually I'm looking at their report, and they've constantly gotten minuses for responding to feedback, that's what we need to see changing. It's less about what they're achieving and how to achieve, which I think is a better conversation to have regardless.
That's fascinating. Just one more question on that, yeah. Sarah. How are you judging how they've responded to feedback, if that's not a daft question?
No. So it would be, as you said, like identifying, like I said, tables such as the misconception ones help with that. But it would be in the case where you didn't have that resource and you would be receiving essays and knowing that. I've said this to that student 3 or 4 times. I've seen this before. Not listening to or taking the active steps to make those skills better for the next time.
Got it. Fantastic. Make those skills stronger. Right, Sarah, what is tip number 3, please?
Okay, tip number 3 is my favorite one. This is my little geek love. And it's one that I spoke about a few years ago. I sort of did some work with Harry Fletcher Wood on it as well. And it is to beware of biases. And it's something that as a young teacher, I had no idea about. And just as I've been teaching now for about, 11 years. So across the course of those 11 years, just figuring out exactly what is going on in my students' minds when, for example, I have a student who I've given, has not received anything under an A star for an essay across the course of the year, and yet still fundamentally believes that they will do badly. Like, what is happening in their processing? That is that them being super anxious, all the feedback I've given will have been positive, will have been wow, whatever it is. And yet somehow that's being interpreted as still a potential to fail. And on the opposite end of that, students who you have been, hammering and who have been receiving D's and D's and are very confident that they will be completely fine in the final exam. So just thinking about this a little bit more and using that to perhaps have a bit better conversations with students by just thinking about where they might be lying on that spectrum of sort of complete negativity bias or a bit too much illusory superiority is the other way.
Wow, I love a bit of bias. This is right up my street, this one. I can certainly relate to teaching both those types of students, the supremely overconfident and then the ones who should be a bit more confident. What can you do, Sarah? What are some of those conversations that you can have with those students? What works in both cases?
Yeah, So it's thinking about trying to think about exactly where those students are lying in regards to their own belief. With top-end students who are particularly critical, I did some studies on this a few years ago, and it was so interesting because I asked them to rank themselves in the class, and they genuinely believed that they were probably middle to bottom. And I think that is even just having that conversation, where do you think you sit in the class is a really nice way to just see how that student's feeling about themselves. But funnily enough, like after doing that, and then you have that conversation like, no, you've been top, but then you become aware as a teacher that actually I know that, but of course they don't. Because in the process of taking in work and marking and looking at it, we have a very good overview, don't we, of how all the kids are performing, but they don't see that. And so again, and it does really come down to using models, really, fundamentally using models, but also having very astute and honest discussions with students. So I guess it's sort of using models with coaching is what I would say is the best way to do it. So a really good example is that I had a boy a few years ago. Again, he was that perfect, like really genuinely believed that he would be fine in the final examination. And I had been giving him an essay for a while, and his context was worth sort of 30% in this essay, was so weak. And I couldn't tell you the amount of times where I was like, use more context. You need to have more context. You need to include more context. And I decided that I would sit him down and I sort of asked him to rank the learning objectives for this essay out of 10 to see how strong he was. So he gave himself like 10 for his ideas because, you know, he thought he was really, really good. And his ideas were good. So I didn't sort of necessarily dispute that one. But then he did say to me, I know you've said that I need more context, so I'm giving myself an 8, right, instead of a 10. And I'm like, okay. And I said, all right, this is really interesting for me because I would have ranked him out of 10 about a 2 in context. It was so clear that he knew it wasn't his best thing. So actually my feedback was being completely disregarded because he knew it. He's like, oh, I'll listen. And to him, adding more context meant maybe a sentence. So the best thing that I think I did at this point is I took another student's essay and I said, look, this is an 8. This is it. Read the context here. Let's highlight the context. This is a context 8. And he was like, oh my God, I am a 2. You know, it's that recalibration of where he sat because he was able to see something that was, you know, again, recalibrating his view of himself. And I think, like I said, I think models are key for this and coaching is a bit of key just to enable students to see exactly where they are and exactly how they sit. And I think models are the best way as well, not to make it personal, just be like, ask students, how good do you think you are at this? You know, what do you think you've done wrong here? Where, you know, out of 10, quantify this level of skill here for me. And even working the other way, a student might say, oh, well, I think I'm a 2. You're like, no, actually, this is a 2. You're sitting, you know, as a way to build confidence if you need to.
This is interesting. Right. I like to try and ask the awkward questions wherever possible on this show. Okay. So here's an awkward one. I can see this working really well, this kind of almost kind of comparative judgment approach or, you know, using exemplars. I can see this working really well with two types of students. So you're overconfident students who need to kind of realize that they're not quite as good as perhaps they think they are, and also your lower confident students who are a lot better than they kind of think they are. What about your students who are low confident but also are really struggling? Because I'm thinking, you know, they think they're struggling and then they see actually, you know what, you are probably getting a 3 or something on this. Is that going to kind of, as soon as you start ranking kids or, you know, comparing, you could imagine for some kids it starts to go the other way. Is that a concern? How does that play out?
Yeah. No, and that is the complete other end of that. So when we have students with illusory superiority in the bottom end, but you've also obviously got the other students. What is really interesting is that obviously this builds in as well with the sort of negativity that is employed upon students when you're in a setting school. You know, if you completely set for a long time, you see a positive progress model at the top end, but a negative usually in the middle to the low, because students get into that bias that I am bad at this and I'm not good at this, and they build that narrative. So they actually did do a study in this in 2008, comparing the way that students thought about themselves in regards to how much progress they made. And they looked at that exact comparison. So low achieving students, one who believed that they were really good and one who didn't. And they saw that the student who believed they were really good made more progress across the course of the year, not necessarily because they were good, but because they were taking more creative risks. So it was about the sort of positive belief in self that encouraged more risk-taking and learning, whereas when you have that negative belief, there seems to be less movement into taking risk in general. In the top end, this is a different effect, because in the top end, if you've got a top performing student who has a massive belief in themselves, they actually make more mistakes because their error detection goes down, because they're taking more risks and their error detection goes down. So that was a really interesting study, I thought. So that's Warren's in 2008, about how you think about yourself and how that then impacts your motivation. So what you could do about that, I mean, and who was it? It was Mark Boys Don't Try is a great book for this as well. He speaks about this in regards to learning and identity and memory, and then obviously that all linking into motivation. So it's a very similar thing with low achieving. It's to break down that narrative and retaliate against that narrative that I can't do this, I'm not good. That absolute truth that student believes is part of their identity. And showing them where, no, actually, look, you have done this. You've done that really well there. And actually lifting that student up so that they're taking more risks, because with more risk will come that progress later.
Wow, this is fascinating. Just one final reflection from me on this, Sarah. So I have a website, diagnosticquestions.com, and we did a big study about three or four years ago now, where we took 10,000 kids' results. And what we do on our app is when kids vote whether they think the answer is A, B, C or D for a multiple choice question, we did an experiment where we asked them to decide how confident they felt in the answer. It's like a 5-point emoji scale. So therefore, for each kid, we had a measure of their kind of accuracy, and then we also had a measure of their confidence. So it was kind of a measure of their understanding versus their perception of their understanding. And it was fascinating because the first thing was the spread of results was all over the show. So you had your classic overconfident kids and your underconfident kids. And you had that at all kind of achievement levels. It wasn't the fact that it was, you know, lower achieving students were underestimating. It was spread out all over the show. Mm-hmm. But the most, well, I don't know if it's surprising or whatever, but one real clear finding came out was that boys really, far more than girls, overstate their perception of their understanding is far greater than their actual understanding, again at all achievement levels. So it wasn't just the case that, you know, lower achieving boys are more confident than lower achieving girls, or higher achieving boys are more confident than higher achieving girls. At every achievement level, the boys were more confident than the girls. It's fascinating, isn't it? Because there's no biological reason why that should be the case or whatever, but it's, and again, it's probably anecdotally, everyone can think of these kind of overconfident boys, but it's fascinating when data plays it out, isn't it?
Completely. And I think that's something, again, sort of slightly touched upon by Mark in his when he's talking about boys and their achievement and Boys Don't Try, etc., that maybe at times when we... maybe that's got to do with how we're processing our feedback towards those students, you know, that maybe because we see a boy who's generally a low achiever and then they do something really well, we say, oh my God, that's so amazing. Maybe we do that sometimes. And then that perpetuates their understanding. Their understanding of being better than what they think they are. But I think the best thing to do is try and figure out exactly where that student lies, because I think even knowing that you've got a lower achieving boy who does have that illusory superiority, does think they're more confident, that is actually really a really useful thing to for you to know as a teacher, because then you can help be like, you know what, actually you haven't done this right, and you know, you can make sure that you are recalibrating their understanding of where they're at so that they are making progress in the way that you need. A really good example which was given about this is when you would write, so if in English, if you're annotating an essay, you would put it on a scale. It would be like a sum, a clear, a developed, and an outstanding. That's usually how the mark schemes sort of go, or an evaluative at the top. And so if I was to write some wider reading done, on the corner, that would probably be a level 2 out of a level 5. So that would be a low, some wider, it's like, it's okay. But somebody who does have that illusory superiority would be like, yeah, I did. Yes, I did some wider reading. You know, yes, I'm so glad they're acknowledging that. Because some wider reading done is actually, can be very much read as a positive. So again, if for that student, maybe perhaps, you know, more wide reading needed is a better way to give feedback there, or to annotate that essay, rather than what you might do where you're like some, because you're trying to say you're a level 2, whereas actually that's being misinterpreted.
Got it. Last question. I could speak to you all day about this, but last question on this bias thing. Well, it's kind of a cheeky one. There's two parts to this question. So I really like this phrase, kind of calibration. I really like this idea of trying to bring students' perception of their understanding in line with their actual understanding. So my two parts of the question are this. One, is there any exception to that where actually you'd want a child to almost not realise where their understanding is? Is there any case you can make where you want perhaps a lower achieving child, you actually want them to feel, you know, better than perhaps their achievement level warrants? And the second part is, over time, the more you do these kind of comparative judgment things and exemplars and feedback, do you find that the calibration improves, that kids generally get a better sense of where they are actually at?
Yeah, so again, I think, again, and I would love, obviously this research with biases is quite new. So I think ultimately, I think watch this space on how that's developing. But what has come out in education so far does seem to suggest that if we can encourage students to, at the lower end, to feel a little bit more positive and then negative about their ability, that they will then take more risks in their learning, which will lead to better progress, like I said. So I think there is a case to be made for some students that encouragement and creative risk-taking, you know, at least they're trying, and by trying they're going to get something down, so fundamentally they'll probably do better than if they got nothing down, right? So there would be quite an obvious reason why a student trying to do better would do better than a student who's not. So yes, I do think that. I think the other really interesting thing that has come out though is that actually negativity bias can be a motivator. So there are some papers that suggest at the top end, and I guess that sort of rides into a little bit of what we see with high performing people not feeling like they're doing it well enough, that actually their negativity bias is a key motivator in their success. So in understanding that, I think it's interesting to then see, right, is this negativity bias at the top end, is this detrimental to that student, you know? Is that perfectionism? Is it bordering perfectionism, which then actually does become something pastorally that you could look into? But otherwise, if it's just that they want to succeed and they want to do better, making sure that, again, it's just about clarity, right? You want to do better. Okay, well, let's work on this then. Let's push that extra level. So it's not saying, oh, they've got a negative bias, they need to know they're amazing necessarily, because if that negativity bias is a slight motivator in that student's in work ethic, then it actually can be used and can be sort of, captured to help move that student and motivate that student further.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating stuff. Right, Sarah, what is tip number four, please?
So tip number four is to use, where possible, dialogic teaching. So I just thought I'd bring this one into the mix, having had quite a unique teaching experience, in that I taught in Australia and I've taught in state and academies and then private and the IB and all of it. And I think one of the things that really got me into even educational research was working with Carl Hendrick when he was doing his PhD on dialogic teaching. And we did a researcher talk probably in 2016 on it. But it was because I was teaching the IB alongside A-level and I never taught the IB before. And part of the IB was that students did an oral presentation, this is astounding, but a 16-year-old, I would have to teach them a particular thing. They would walk in, there would be unseen envelopes, and they would pick up the envelope and it would be either an extract from a Shakespeare play we'd studied or a poem from a poet we had studied. And they had to speak to me about it for 8 minutes.
Wow.
Without me interjecting. And so much of building and assessing for that along the course of the curriculum design was to get students to talk as much as possible and have confidence in talking. Again, seeing a 16-year-old pick up a Keats poem and speak for 8 minutes about it, they cannot hide. If you're really listening to them, they cannot hide their knowledge. To succeed in that, they need to know it incredibly well. And part of the ways that we would build the confidence in this is by using Harkness or by having lessons where we would say, throw that poem in the classroom and just sit at the desk and say absolutely nothing. And actually, I wouldn't even listen to the students. I would just track who's talking and listen to what they're saying. Sorry, I wouldn't even look at them. I would just be on the desk, because if you really do tune into how your students are talking, you will really get an understanding as to how much they know. And I think the more we use this sometimes when we believe that our students are at that point of mastery, you wouldn't do this when they don't know nothing, because then the talk will be empty, much like throwing them into an assessment without any knowledge. But as you walk through, you say, right, we're going to just discuss this extract today. I'm going to put it on the table. I want you all to discuss. And if you track how those students are responding, it's a really nice, clean way to assess how much they know.
Keep going. Please keep going. This is fascinating.
So one of the ways that I would assess, and this isn't the case for everyone, but I did write about this, and it's drawing to my Australian roots, but I did, you know, we love an acronym in teaching, so it was just a nice clear way for me to remember, but as a sort of ACDC approach, nailed it. Whereas listening to where the students are just agreeing as the A. So when you're hearing, right, so I'm tracking, say a boy, I'm not sure, is he just sat there agreeing? If he's agreeing, then I think, is he listening? You know, that would be a really interesting way for them to move in and be like, oh, what do you agree with? You know, if you find them just agreeing, it could be a nice way to identify that they don't actually know. So there's a knowledge gap. The second is, are they contradicting? So that's quite interesting. Like, are they like, oh, I don't agree with that, I think this, in which case you could be able to see that students are, you know, evaluating internally, they've thought about that idea, they're able to say actually another idea exists, or that's a student who's read a different paper and has just this other, maybe a tutor. Tutors told them the right answer. So there's reasons. So if they're just doing that, then I think that you could then have nice discussions, right? Well, why did you think that student's point was relevant then? You know, nice discussions to just bring that conversation, that knowledge to the surface. Another is, are they developing on those ideas? And again, you can teach those. So that's the, so yes, I agree with, you know, and I thought that that symbol also represented, you know, so is it a sort of nice development of the idea that's happening, or do they just always change the idea? And again, you could see changing the idea as perhaps that student has a particular school of knowledge, but again, and then moving to that, back to what I said earlier about perhaps route knowledge that they have, where like, I know I can say this and put this idea out there, but I'm not actually responding or engaging to the ideas that are being put forward in a flexible way. So I think that's a really nice way to think about how students are responding and talking. And again, either intervening as a teacher, if you feel it is right to be like, right, we're going to stop there. I'm just going to ask this question and I'm just going to challenge people on that idea. And then enable that to go back to your teaching and be like, right, I definitely know that this student has this particular school of thought, but they haven't yet developed that. So what can I do in my classroom? How can we build on this? How can we discuss more? Or how can I reteach this other perspective so that that student understands that both schools of thought are a nice way to articulate? And I think it was Tom Sherrington a little while ago, he said, he sort of spoke about this briefly with you, but it was on classroom talk in general, making sure that all of this happens with sort of the accurate sentence stems up on the board, you know, just giving those platforms to say, yeah, I absolutely agree, but I would consider, you know, I have a class at the moment and they are incredible. They're very, very a mixed set, but all quite vulnerable students, quite fragile. So we are working every week to have a debate lesson. So every week we have a debate lesson and we'll put up an idea and, you know, we might do some research around it or whatever. And then I basically say they have to position themselves in the either agree or disagree. So it has to be predominantly one or the other. Now they can say obviously that they mostly agree with, but also understand. But at the very end of that, I say, right, I'm going to give you a minute now, and I want you to think about your sentence of your one sentence summary. So in summary, I believe that, you know, and giving those sentence stems so that they're able to put forward their argument in a considered, measured, but also an evaluative way. And all of that is modelled for them throughout the process of those discussions. But obviously, as you get to A-level, or, you know, and again, something I stole from the IB that I absolutely use in A-level now, is just getting my students to have a conversation. They might have to go away and read some articles, different perspectives, different theories that I give them. But then this conversation is going to be a Harkness conversation. You are talking, and I am just there to really see how well they are engaging with that material and able to articulate that material.
Flip it back, Sarah. This is a biggie. This is good. This, right. What you're going to have to put up with now is just a big ramble where I try and pour out thoughts on this. God knows what's going to come out of my mouth here. First thing to say, I think that 8 minute thing, I would hate that. That is hard. That's hardcore. That, right? That, yeah. Speak 8 minutes on a subject without interrupting. That's serious stuff. Wow. One thing that I think certainly gets underrated, I've underrated how complex it is to have a productive conversation with a fellow student. And what I've done in the past is, you know, done an example on the board or whatever, discuss it with your partner. And the thing is, I've not appreciated what a skill that is to have that kind of conversation. I really like the idea of these verbal kind of stems, these sentence structures to have. It almost feels a bit, I don't know about you, it feels a bit awkward at first when you're saying to kids, you know, respond in this way. But the more you stick at it, the more they get used to it. And as long as you explain why you're doing this, and it'll transition to be able to write more fluently and so on, I think it works well. I'll tell you where I struggle. And I'm interested in your take on this. I find whenever kids are discussing things in pairs, I find it hard to assess, because versus them all holding up a mini whiteboard or something, because I can't get around, you know, it's hard to get around everybody and dedicate enough time to listening. So I'm interested in when you're circulating the room, or you mentioned kind of sitting at your desk and listening, are you targeting particular groups? I'm interested in how you get as much useful information as possible. And the second part is, I'm also interested in how you share good practice. Because if kids are like writing things down in the books and mini whiteboards, I can take a photo of that, I can grab it up and so on. But if I overhear a good conversation, or, you know, a good dialogue that's going on, how do I share that with the rest of the class? So they're my two questions. How are you assessing, and how are you sharing good practice?
Yeah, it's again, good question. So I think when I'm talking about these class discussions, they are whole class, usually. When you get to the point of complete autonomy, you would be looking more at a sort of A-level thing. Like I said, this is something for the end of. You want to put this at the end, probably more so when students have knowledge. And I think for that exact reason, that if I put it in pairs, you're right, I'm not sure, I can't be certain that conversations are happening that are honest. So if I sit at my desk and every single person is involved in this conversation, then I'm hearing everything that is said. So I did this with a GCSE class quite recently. And again, it was quite nice, because it was about, like, so when I heard a really great idea, I would then interject and say, right, what Steph has just said is a really brilliant idea. Steph, can you draw everyone's attention to what page that was on? And can you repeat that for me, please? And then what ended up happening, which was quite nice, was that students would then say to each other, oh, I really liked that, can you repeat that? And again, it's modeling that idea that we're all here to share, we're all here together in that learning journey. And of course, I'm saying this, there's obviously so many processes behind doing this, such as, you know, learning behaviors and having that nice environment, if you can possibly get it, where students are listening to each other. But where you build that then students can come together and listen to each other. And then even if you notice that a student is quite not responding to that conversation, you could just obviously give a prompt if you're willing, you know, okay, well, what did everyone think about this? And then draw attention to one other student. But I think the process of me bringing it up today is because I think, and it comes to something that you've touched on just in your questions, I think as teachers, actually, we accidentally infer far too much. And there's great, great, you know, dialogues and scripts of teachers. And I would 100% encourage every single teacher to record a part of the lesson and script it and actually see what's going on with this. It's the same with verbal feedback, because often when a student is saying an idea, a teacher will actually sometimes just infer what the student was sort of saying to the right answer and be like, oh yes, yeah, that. And then conclude that that student understands because they've actually made that leap. Whereas by having more of a dialogical classroom, and it goes back to how I was phrasing before, I think you end up asking better questions. If you're thinking about, right, is this student actually exploring that? Are they developing on that idea? Are they just being contradictory to the students? Well, why do you think that's contradictory? Why do you think? And I think it enables you to really dig a little bit more deeper into exactly how much that student does know. And instead of just being like, right, I'm going to ask a question, we've had a little bit of a chat, but I've actually inferred from that student who was sort of on the right track what they meant. You know, I know what they meant. Oh yes, you meant this. So I write that on the board and then we move on. Whereas actually, there's a lot to be said to be like, right, is that quite it? Like, have a discussion. Can we actually get to the purpose of that and throwing it back just that little bit more often?
Really interesting. Just one bonus question. This is a terrible question to ask you. I apologize. Before Please. We move on to your fifth tip, a really bad question. You mentioned you've taught in Oz, in the US, and also in the UK. Obviously, this kind of school-specific stuff going on and so on. Are there any general differences that you would pick up between the three countries that you think are fairly valid in terms of how they approach the teaching of English or teaching in general? Any trends that you think are kind of generalizable?
Yeah, I will just correct. Sorry, I've taught in the UK and Australia. I've taught just in the UK. I've taught in state sector academies. That's probably where. So just
got
to,
it. Sorry. Sorry. Across UK and us. Like, let's go for that.
So, I mean, that's only two. So it's a general things. I think it's hard. It's a really hard thing for me to actually reflect on, because I don't think I have the right amount of knowledge to do so. Apologies. But I do think my experience has been very varied. Like, I taught with Indigenous students in Australia, so there's 25% Aboriginal Australian population at the school, which was incredible. But it was so poorly funded that I was teaching English, history, geography, and maths. So that was my first job outside of uni. So I was doing all sorts of things there. I think there is a freedom in the state sector in Australia that I loved and that I missed when I came over. I did feel that moving over to the UK, where obviously there's great things about Ofsted, but I did move over 9 years ago when we were on that sort of pendulum swing, weren't we, over here, of being all about, like, you know, the sort of blown up volleyballs with your learning objectives on them that we threw around the room sort of thing, which blew my mind. I was like, this is why. And it was so difficult for me to arrive from a state sector over in Australia, where there was this kind of nice, beautiful freedom, to then this very, you know, I remember, and actually it's so interesting that you've asked this, because I caught up with one of my mentors in my very first school. I was living and working in Leeds, actually, for 2.5 years. And she just recently published, and we were at a conference together, and I hadn't seen her in 9 years. And we were joking because I said I remembered my first lesson observation when I moved. And I love teaching. Like, teaching, it's really lame, but I'm from, you know, quite a low income family. My cap, my goal was to become a teacher. And I feel like I did that now. I'm like, okay, cool. I don't know what else to do because I made my goal, you know. At uni, they were like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I was like, just being a really good teacher. So that was always the thing that I wanted to do. But so I moved over. I was in my first lesson observation. I'd received really, really good grades and results in Australia, and, you know, had sort of came second in my course and loads of stuff. And so, you know, lesson observation, I was really excited for it because no one had seen me teach in the UK. And she took me aside and she said, that was a really good lesson. Like, this was a rough school, a really challenging group of pupils who were sat there working quietly, working independently, asking great questions. She was like, this was a great lesson, but you would have failed. And I was like, no, and she's not, you know, we're good friends. She wasn't, never, it wasn't criticism at all. I said it actually helped me massively. Because I was confused. And I was like, why would I fail? She's like, well, you didn't do a plenary, and then you didn't check for understanding like five times and hold up paddle pop sticks. And I was like, oh, this is crazy. This is bonkers. And it probably was partly what influenced me in getting into educational research, because I'm like, this can't be what good learning needs to be. You know, so it was a fascinating journey. I'm not sure if that answered your question, but
no,
there's
true.
Been lots of observations that I've had having done both of those different systems and situations.
That's dead interesting. Right, Sarah, what is your fifth and final tip, please?
So it's actually quite a nice segue, actually, what you just asked into my final one, which is something that I just recently wrote about. And it's something that I think I'm more and more becoming quite impassioned about, because I think it is super fundamental. And it is a tip to leaders, this one, to ignite CPD culture. I have been a teacher who thought that CPDs were a waste of time, and that's probably because the ones I was going to were. I have been part of being entirely critical of CPD. But I think that if you can get it right, and if you can explore exactly how to ignite CPD culture within your school, you will fundamentally have better staff retention. You know, like, we're looking at all of these numbers, and I thought it was really crucial to bring up with you today, because all of these numbers and graphs that are coming out recently about teacher retention and, you know, not being able to hold young teachers down, and how actually schools are still doing CPD, you know, ineffectually. It's fundamentally that.
That's a good one. So I guess the obvious question is, how do we do this, yeah. Sarah? Because you're right, I visit lots of different schools and see lots of different approaches to CPD. What's been your takeaway? What are some of the good things that schools can do?
Yes. So I think the reason this is at my forefront is because I was just recently at the Festival of Education, and I was with quite an amazing few leaders and educators who I honestly just walked away and I was like, I love teaching. I love education. I like walked away again, just completely buzzing, just to talk to people. But I think, you know, fundamentally where schools go wrong, and it's drawing on, I use the term here, ignite CPD culture, is because I'm drawing back to sort of David Weston here about a sort of campfire leadership idea. But it is to have clear targets for a school. Like, when we know that educational research takes time and needs to be measured. So if you're a school, it's sort of hard to see that you're going to an effective CPD session when you every other week it's a different topic and there's no follow-up and you're not integrating anything. So actually, if you start from, right, what is our school culture? Who are we? What do we need? And you say, right, we're going to implement a year, 2 years, 3 years. And it is that longer term sort of slow burn ignition approach. Right, we've got these three targets. We need to measure before, we need to see what's going on before, and we need to discuss before with all staff, of course, because then you see, right, there is a purpose to this. We're evaluating, as businesses would, you know, or as other places would, we're evaluating this area of our school, you know, whatever it is, low achieving boys, whatever it is. And then we're going to have a couple of CPDs along the course of the year to provide our knowledge, as well as feedback from departments as to how it's going, how it's being implemented. And again, you could do this initially as a sort of opt-in approach. It doesn't need to be every single staff sitting down all the time. You know, you could say, right, we're going to have a core group who are sort of fundamentally in charge of feeding back this. Obviously, all staff will go to the CPDs, but we have a core group throughout the year feeding back to SLT, talking to other departments, talking together, and then we can present and discuss and reevaluate at the end and talk to staff about how they're going. So I think that's the thing. I think schools, you know, sometimes, and I've definitely seen it where you've got like a CPD schedule at the beginning of the year, and it's sort of like November 3rd TBC, and it's like, well, what's the point of something that is to be confirmed if we're going to look at this as being an opportunity to learn and to really engage with what's happening within our school? It does probably need to have a bit of planning behind it in the first instance, and not just be something that we are tacking on at the end of the school day.
Yeah, this is another biggie. So just a few thoughts from me on this one. So I'm very fortunate. I get to visit lots of schools, and I'm obsessed with how they deliver CPD, because often I come in as kind of a bit of an external speaker. And one of my questions is always, what's going to happen after this? Like after I go home or whatever, like I try and wherever possible say, can I come like, you know, 3 days over the course of the year as opposed to one? But if that's not possible, what's the plan once I go away? What's the plan after this CPD? And even if you have an internal CPD, if it's just a one-off, like, how do you know? It's like the world's worst lesson, right? You know, you teach a lesson, you think you've nailed it, unless you revisit that and you've no way of knowing whatsoever. So, yeah, one-off CPD is really problematic.
Really problematic. Yeah, it's a great analogy.
The other thing that's problematic is, I saw this the other day in a school. So their CPD for the year that they were aiming to box off within 12 months, they wanted to sort out checking for understanding, retrieval, they wanted to do responsive teaching and cognitive load theory chucked into the mix. And I'm thinking that's a decade's worth of stuff to try and get your head around that. And that feeds into the one-off thing, right? We'll have our retrieval CPD, then we'll have our check for understanding CPD, and it's just a disaster waiting to happen. But my final thing is, I'm interested in your take on this. I'll tell you what I think is really effective, but it's quite hard to do, but if you can, I think it's brilliant. And that's where you have CPD, you know, have it on whatever, you know, check for understanding, whatever it may be. And then before people meet up again, you have some way of assessing how they're kind of responding to it. So whether it's drop into lessons, whether they record things, whatever it is. And then the start of the next session, as opposed to it being a general, okay, what's worked and what hasn't, whoever's running the CPD can almost do like examples and non-examples. Because just like you would do with a lesson, exactly. There's good, like, just like we know there's a difference between what we teach kids and what they actually understand. It's the same with CPD, right? So if you can go around in the interim and you've seen an example of this, but you've also seen a really interesting non-example, somebody who thinks they're doing retrieval practice, but actually it's not quite doing it for whatever reason. It's not quite what we talked about and so on. Having those exemplars, I think, so useful. But I don't know about you, I very rarely see it with CPD. It tends to be almost, right, we'll start from scratch when we do the kind of second session. I don't know what your take is on that.
Yeah, no, I would completely agree. And I think that's everything that, you know, sort of leadership does need to look at. Again, where you do see yourself in situations where you have worked with inspirational leaders who are getting this right, then you know it, you feel it within the culture. And I think it does need to be that sort of follow-up discussion. Here's where it's going well. This is where, you know, take from this, like, how can you try this in your department? Does it work? If it doesn't work, why doesn't it work? What's the difference? What's the shift there? You know, and really just opening up those conversations about what we're doing on the practice side of our profession, as well as the sort of general subject knowledge and stuff. And of course, a great CPD, is a great CPD target, of course, is to enable your staff time to develop their subject knowledge, because subject knowledge is key. So be like, you know what, I want everyone to just be a bit more reignited in their subject knowledge. Let's see that happen. And that's, again, another great practice target to have on a CPD. But you're right, they need to be much more focused. And then again, that constant discussion and evaluation, because otherwise it is pointless. It is there's just like that. It might be, maybe you have a CPD where you get another little practice for your toolbox of teaching. And that's okay too. But when you're looking at schools saying, you know, we want to change these things, it can't just be the one-off. Like another really good example is, I was talking to a friend who was at a school where they're like, right, we're going to put on these like after-school CPDs that are about well-being and teacher well-being so that you can be better by the end of the year. And I was like, well, have they actually captured how teachers are feeling about their well-being? And then will they do that at the end? And even so, they will have to differentiate between the fact that the well-being hasn't been just that we all got a pay rise the day before we gave you the final well-being essay. You know, it's that you fundamentally believe that having these six sessions after school across the course of this year really contributed to your general sense of well-being. And if it didn't, is there a point to it?
That's brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant. Well, Sarah, we've done five biggies here, right? There's no messing around.
I know.
With
I'm so sorry. I could have done little. I was thinking about it. I could do little teacher things, but these are the things that I love and that I'm really interested in. And I know they are a bit bigger philosophically, but I think they do oversee quite a lot that we're talking about on the day to day.
No, this is absolutely brilliant. We have the big five like this, and then we'll have another guest who'll say, remember to put your lids on your mini whiteboard pens. So we have everything on this show. So this is absolutely perfect. So now it's time for me to hand over to you, Sarah. What should listeners check out of yours? And I'll put links to these in the show notes.
Yeah, so I've got a blog. It's perspected.wordpress. So I regularly write on that. I've written quite a few chapters for various people, but I also have my research ed assessment book as well. So that's me personally, but I have given a list of various other readings, which are things that I think are really important. Education Endowment Foundation evaluations on feedback and of dialogue, the dialogic classroom, Robin McPherson's A Teaching Life, which I wrote about recently, which is on CPD culture. So everything I've sort of talked about today, you will put those references up. I'm not going to, some Dylan Williams stuff. So everything that sort of underpins, the research that underpins the things that I've spoken about, I've passed on a list for you, which I'm sure you will put up.
That's brilliant. Yep, that'll all be in the show notes. Well, Sarah, this has been an absolute pleasure. I've learned loads. I've loads to think about that.
So
I couldn't ask for more. So thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.